This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And action!
Hello and welcome to episode 390 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk
filmmaking.
From indie film to studio films to high-end TV and
everything in between.
How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to
royally F them up.
In our very, very
bumble opinion,
with a reference to The Beekeeper today, which
has a lot of buzz. It's flying off the shelves.
Oh my gosh, stop it. Someone stop him. Hello, I'm Charles Alderson. Welcome back to me. If you missed me last week,
welcome back to me. didn't sound at all arrogant there.
Humble, obviously.
Welcome back to me.
Bumble. Welcome back to me. I'm Giles Alderson. I'm writer, director, producer. And who are you?
Dom Lenoir. Writer, producer, director.
You did it in different ways. I like that.
Yeah.
And guess what, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, animals of all insects, shapes, sizes. We have on The Beekeeper, director and writer David Eyre.
Oh,
yes, we do. Dom sat down for an amazing chat with David and talked all about a load of amazing things to help you filmmakers. Dom, shall you go into a tiny bit of detail about what they will learn from this week's episode?
Yes, it was a filmed interview too, so you'll be able to see some very handsome shots of us.
Yeah, you especially.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So we talked about David's cutting his teeth on Anton Fuqua's Training Day, which was his first sort of big film that he wrote, directing his first feature with Harsh Times, working on a big Brad Pitt vehicle with Fury, how brilliant Jason Statham is to work with and why he's always been on David's hit list, why he wanted to make Beekeeper a fun OTT action epic, the challenges and benefits of working with studios, creating story beats within action sequences, the magic of shooting with UK crews, and wanting to explore different genres such as a musical.
Wow, that sounds very fun. So listen, thank you so much for listening. This is the Filmmakers Podcast. Me and Dom were just chatting before we went on air about our 400th episode.
David Eyre?
David, before we went on David Eyre. Very good. Because our 400th episode is coming up for you in 10 episodes time, which technically in podcast terms, in our hit rate could be 2 weeks if we did every day. We won't, but it's very likely to be in 2 months and a half. So what should we do for it, Dom? We should do something very exciting.
400 episodes that me and Giles haven't made a penny.
Doing all this for the love.
For the love of sharing the knowledge and meeting great people.
That's very true.
Which is rewarding
itself. It's a reward in itself. It is.
But anyone listening out there that wants to pay us some money, that would be great.
But we're not begging, obviously.
No, of course not.
But for our 400th, we thought we'd do something really fun. We're not sure yet. We're either going to get an amazing guest on, which we might anyway, and to be honest,
a GoFundMe.
We might do a GoFundMe for my holiday fund. Or we might have an amazing free week at the moment. If Dom, do you want to list off that amazing list that you just gave me a minute ago?
Yeah, let's start. We go One Life, Oppenheimer, Boys in the Boat. The end, we start from Argyle, Society of Snow, Rustin,
The Promised Land,
The Iron Claw, Memory,
Bob Marley, One Love, True Detective, Night Country, Wicked Little Letters, Damsel, Poor Things. I mean, and we're not just saying we just talked about those films. We had either the producers, the writers, and the directors on talking about how they made their film. That's just in the last couple of months, ladies and gentlemen. There has been nearly 400 episodes on exactly that, and indie filmmakers as well, how they got their films made and how they did it, which is the whole important thing about inspiring you to go and make your films.
We've got another unreasonable guest next week as well.
Yes, we have. How unreasonable were they? Were they like throwing chairs?
Yes. Well, no, I mean, just unreasonably great.
Yeah, I got that.
You know, I mean, we had a 45-minute interview with Ty Sheridan, he's one of the biggest upcoming actors around. He's been leading a Spielberg film. He was, you know, Jeff Nichols' film. He was like one of the main characters, Mud. I mean, you know, he's just done his first film with his own production company, Asphalt City, with him and Sean Penn as the leads. I mean, he's an amazing actor, and we sort of sat down for 45 minutes. So yeah, just big guests and tons of good knowledge.
So more of that coming up, which means our 400th episode. Would you, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, like to join us for a little gathering? We're kind of maybe doing a live event, maybe, but it's not. Maybe a Q&A. It's like a live podcast. It's not making film, maybe.
Maybe
a live event. Let's see, because that might be fun. You can throw questions at us on the podcast. You can be on the podcast. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you can throw the questions on like pieces of projectiles.
So let's see what happens.
We might do that, or we might just have a ludicrously big guest again.
We might just do that. So David Ayer, what an absolute legend. He talked about such interesting things on the episode, but I think we should talk about them after the episode, after you've chatted with David, and we can go dive deep working with crews, because both me and Dom have just done that, making our films in the last couple of weeks.
We have, yeah.
So let's come back to that.
One thing that was really exciting about David Ayer was he's one of those people where you get into the room and he's just got power. And I just mean like his presence. Like he's not there to give me a hard time, but he's not there to make it easy either. He's there to like answer questions sensibly, and he's waiting for good questions. And I really felt like I was working to get good answers, and I felt like he was really working to give them back. And it was kind of exciting, you know, at the end of it. You know, he said, you know, great interview, and I felt like I'd earned it. And you know, interviewing is not my main thing. I feel like I'm a filmmaker, but I really dug deep to get some good answers out of him, and it was a nice experience. And also it's good practice when you're, you know, dealing with people that have had to weather the storms with big budgets and studios, and you know, they've got that kind of energy about them. It's good. It sort of levels up your own game.
Yes, I like that. So he didn't give you a hard time. He might have given you a harsh time, which was his film, which is his debut film. He actually made for $2 million, starring Christian Bale. That's quite incredible. I love this movie. I loved Harsh Times. I thought it was fantastic. And some of his other credits before we get into David Ayer, not literally, but on the podcast, is U571, which starred Matthew McConaughey, was his first screen. He wrote the screenplay for that. As his first, what, can you believe it? $62 million movie as your first movie out the gate. That's pretty good. Then he did Fast and the Furious. It's not bad. The first one, wrote that. Then he wrote and co-produced Training Day. Then went on to write Dark Blue and SWAT and Taking Lives before directing, producing, and writing Harsh Times, which was just mentioned. He then directed End of Watch, which starred Jake Gyllenhaal, before he directed Sabotage, and then Fury, which starred Brad Pitt, and then he directed Suicide Squad, which he directed and wrote, which starred all the massive names like Will Smith, Margot Robbie, Viola Davis, David Harbour, oh my gosh, Jared Leto, the list goes on. The Beekeeper is out now in all good cinemas, and it's actually on Sky Cinema right now in the UK.
Also in bad cinemas.
Yes, it is. Sometimes you don't want to frequent those because you never know.
It's just in every cinema.
You never know what's going to happen. But it is on Sky Movies right now. You can buy and keep, or you can buy and watch that right now.
It's been a surprise hit, Beekeeper. I mean, it wasn't a surprise that it's done well, but it's done really well at the box office, and it's got a lot of buzz, as we said.
I think we might use that pun three times now, so.
Yes, yeah.
So we should probably buzz off and let our lovely listeners listen to this week's episode. Here it is. This is David Ayer, chatting with Dom Lenoir. See you on the other side.
Be you on the other side.
Look. You're a blessing, Mr. Clay. This place was crabgrass and weeds, and you brought it back to life.
Mrs. Parker and I were friends. She was like family. She was the only person who ever took care of me.
I just got a message saying that there's a problem with my computer.
Yes, ma'am, we got this.
Yesterday, she shot herself.
This is private property.
Do you know what they do here? Scamming the weakest in our society?
Buddy, I'm counting three.
One, two, three. There, I did it for you. No, you can't take it. No, you can't. I'm gonna burn this place to the ground. No, you can't take that away
from me. Will you stomp his ass out?
You're telling me one man did this. The only thing you know is he's a beekeeper.
A beekeeper?
Well, that's not good.
Beekeepers is a special program outside the chain of command.
I protect the hive. When the system is out of balance, I correct it.
We have laws for these things.
Until they fail, then you have me.
Hi, David. Welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast. How are you feeling?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Are you enjoying London?
I love London. I'm glad to be back. It's kind of my second home.
So The Beekeeper is a fantastic action film. I love a film with Jason Statham. I love your movies as well.
Oh, thank you.
It's a really enjoyable film. It's nice to see a fun action film. Obviously, your range of filmography kind of goes from very serious to slightly more on the wacky, exciting sort of, exciting side. So can you talk about how this came to be, how this began?
Yeah, absolutely. I got this great script from Kurt Rimmer. I'm reading it. Has this mythology that's quite interesting, quite magnetic about the beekeepers and just great character, but also this plot that just kind of goes crazy. Mm. And so as a filmmaker, it just made a lot of sense. And I've always wanted to challenge myself with making a film that reminded me of why I became a filmmaker. And that's movies like Die Hard and 48 Hours and Lethal Weapon, just those fun action movies. And I feel like a little bit of the fun is missing from cinema right now.
I think you're completely right. And I grew up on those films. Like I used to watch Die Hard, Lethal Weapon on repeat, like every sort of weekend. And they were just fun, good quality movies. You know, they had all the action, but they also had likable comedic characters as well. And they had that balance right. And I think that's really disappeared from cinema. So what's the process once you get the script in terms of deciding what you might want to do to it, what your terms are of engaging on a project?
It's really about, I have to ask myself, do I know how to make this? And how am I going to do this? And then it's a business. So can you do it for the money? And then the opportunity to work with Jason was just, something I couldn't turn down. So it was a little scary for me because it is outside of my normal work. And I learned that not only can I have fun in this space, but I can thrive in this space.
So what was he already part of the package when it arrived? Because it does feel like a Jason Statham film, but he's made some classic films over the years.
That's it. He was very baked in. It was already sort of crafted for him. And then my job as a filmmaker, as a director, was to establish a relationship with him and really understand his strengths and abilities, which are kind of immense. Mm. And this is a guy that does his own stunts. And normally, when you shoot action, you're working around a stunt double. And how do I get the actor's face in? And they do things now where they'll digitally place the actor's face onto the stunt double's body and things like that. So to not have to play any of those games and to have such an incredible, athletic, skilled stunt performer who also happens to be your star, I mean, that was a privilege.
Are there ever things from a stunt perspective that are challenging in terms of when maybe what you're allowed to do and what he's allowed to do, what he wants to do, what the studios don't want to do, that kind of thing?
Well, you can't hurt people for real. That's bad. You have to do everything safely, but it also has to be repeatable. you know, because you have to do it again or get it just right. I think it was just really a matter of developing the choreography, because there's so many stunt scenes. There's a lot of action in this. And in each action sequence, we wanted to be its own little story with, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and have it play satisfying. So that is a lot easier to say than do. And but, you know, having Jason on board and having Jeremy Marinas, who did all the fight choreography, it wasn't easy, but it was possible.
So what were some of those early conversations with Jason about? Were they firstly sort of story and character? Like, how did that unfold? What did you maybe want from him? What did he want from you?
It was really, for me, everything is character. You always have to approach it from character. And I feel like Jason, you know, this action icon, this action superstar, I felt like I wanted to get to know his heart a little bit and to put him into a little bit of an emotional world first, then have him go into action land. And so it was really, who is Adam Clay? Who is this character? What parallels in your own life, you know, are similar to that? Who do you care about? Who are the vulnerable people in your life you want to protect? And when you come into character like that, you can't go wrong.
Because he's a very likable character. I mean, I remember first seeing him in the Taxi Driver sort of film as the Transporter.
Yes.
And he just brings that hilarious British, you know, understated, you know, charisma, really, which really comes off in this film as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is a guy who is a giant in British cinema and has played so well in that space, who then transitions into Hollywood and absolutely conquered it. So it was just kind of fun to come to the UK and make a movie with Jason and really take advantage of all his strengths.
Yeah. What were some of the differences from shooting in the UK from shooting in America for you? Good or bad?
No disrespect to my American brothers, yeah. But there's something kind of magical about making a film here. There's a culture of cinema and a respect for the craft, and there's really these generational, you know, collaborators and you know, just even the grip department. You know, Alex Fraser, his dad was my key grip on Fury, and to work with the same people again, and there's just such a respect for it in an artistry. As a director, it feels like you're making a movie.
So what were some of the stunt kind of preparations that you went through once you'd got the script, you're starting to think about the movie, you're talking with Jason. What were some of those? Because you talked about the story within the action sequence.
Yes.
And I think that's a really important thing that's often skimmed over in movies. Often you have the camera, you can't really figure out what's going on. You can't plot the geography.
Yeah.
And every action sequence does need to have a start, middle, and end. The audience actually understands for them to go along with the emotional arc of the story as well. And you've done, you know, really nice, clean, you know, visible action in this. So I'd be interested how you sort of started to approach those sequences.
With fear and trembling. Wildly difficult. It's wildly difficult. So much planning goes into it. It starts with a little bit of tone. What kind of scene is this? Who are the bad guys? What style of fighting is this? And then you do choreography, and you know, we do what's called stunt viz, which is they'll record the choreography from different angles, assemble it together, you study the angles, and then figure out how to duplicate it on set if it's working. And there's a lot of sort of redos and erasing the chalkboard and starting over. So it's a patient process, and when you do have that planning and have that detail, it's going to show on the day. And then you always, no matter how much you plan, there's always a little bit of jazz to be had on the day.
Yeah.
Because with the lighting and the camera and the, whoa, it looks amazing over here. So let's just take everything and go and adjust it. So you have to be a bit of a hunter. When you see it, you go for it.
And do you do a lot in terms of working with the locations? I mean, just an example, obviously on the bridge, there's a sequence where the car gets taken over with human attached to it,
yes.
Flung into the water, or the telephone in the call center. It's obviously, that's a very like story embedded use, and it provides a laugh when you're watching it, but it's actually completely intuitive and it makes perfect sense. Was that in the script, or is that something you kind of go through in the location hunting and the development sort of stages?
It could be a little bit of both. So you always want to take advantage of the environment. And you know, just something like, oh, let's hit a guy with a phone. That'll be funny because they're evil telemarketers, Justice. Mm-hmm. The phone, now you need a rubber phone. You have to build the asset. You have to get the real phone. You do a mold. You do a rubber squeeze, they call it. And then now you have that asset on set. And all that takes time and money to prepare. So you can't make it up as much as I think people assume you do. And then just something like the stunt with the truck, that was all boarded out. You know, so I had storyboards, put them on foam core, have rows of them on set. And then as we tick off the shots, you know, and what can seem like a very simple shot can be hours of rigging, special preparation, special equipment, you know, strange kit that we use just for an instant on camera. And it's creating the illusion of seamlessness, but with this very technical, very safe, very intense process.
Mm. What are some of those conversations that you have at the start of a movie? Because obviously it's a Hollywood movie in terms of budget. And there's obviously certain decisions that you've got to make in terms of, okay, this is really important to me. This is not so important. The cast costs this much. So how did you prioritize once you got the script? Once you got some of the main sort of pieces in place, which sequences you really wanted to spend the money on, which ones you maybe thought weren't quite as important.
So now you're triggering my PTSD. That's the hardest part of filmmaking, I think. And what people don't really understand is no matter how big the movie, you never have enough money to make it. And so as a filmmaker, it's all about priorities. And there'll be things where it's like, this is sacred. We can't invade this. This is crucial to the success of the film. And then there's other things where it's like, I can give that up, or I can find a smarter, cheaper, better way to do it. But I've found that the pressure of making things work and being able to do it on time and on budget forces you into creative solutions. Mm. And I'm all about just the trickery and the illusion of it. You know, how you place a camera, how you place lights can make an incredible difference in what you're seeing on screen. And so just being smart about it. And as I say, you know what? I'm going to point the camera this way. Don't worry about all this. We don't need to spend a dime on this. Let's spend all the money on this.
So what were some of the, maybe the inputs from the studio once you'd sort of signed on and you'd got it cast? Was there any things that maybe you wanted to go in one direction? There were certain things where they were thinking, okay, let's go in this direction. How do you navigate that sort of territory?
I mean, at the end of the day, it is a business. And I think the important part, as long as you know what movie you're making, they know what movie you're making, and you're in agreement on it, you know.
Yeah, no one's in denial or incongruent.
Yeah, and I think, you know, filmmakers can get themselves in situations where I have this vision, but I'm not going to be honest about it.
Yeah.
It's my little secret thing. But as long as you're fully open and transparent about what you're doing and you sort of check the business boxes, I had immense freedom on this.
Yeah.
I had immense freedom on this. And that's where I'm at my best, is when I'm trusted as a filmmaker.
Yeah, definitely. And then you can sort of deliver the final vision that you've got in your mind. So let's talk about the other casting. Once you've got Jason on board, you've got the sort of the core of the package. Is there much thought in terms of, okay, well, we need to cast these certain names to make sure the package works overall? Or how does that work for you?
You know, I had a lot of leeway in that area, but for me, I love working with actors and I love working with great actors. And, you know, Jason is the captain of the football team. And then you surround him with other amazing players and it just elevates everybody's game. Mm. So, you know, getting Jeremy Irons, Josh Hutcherson, Minnie Driver, Gemma Redgrave, all these incredible actors just add such reality to it. But they also help create these characters that help sell the world, you know? And I think it's also kind of fun for the audience because these faces pop up and I know who that is.
Yeah. So what is your rehearsal process more away from the action, more into the drama scenes and the, you know, those kind of interpersonal relationships?
Well, it depends upon the movie, but I like to rehearse a lot. I like to sit down. A rehearsal can be just simply a page turn and talking about character. Why is my character saying this? What does my character feel in this moment? Or, you know, here's some biographical information. This is where you're coming from. And you always think of any character. You know, everyone's the hero of their own movie, right? So a supporting character isn't there to be a supporting character. A supporting character is there is because that's their life.
Yeah.
And they have this entire trajectory of life, and we're just seeing this moment. So when you can build out that sort of life force in a person and that sort of, you know, CV of their history and where they're going, it's going to reflect in the overall reality of the ensemble.
Yeah, and I suppose on an action film as well, you've got very limited time because the action set pieces take up so much time.
Yes. Yeah. So
can we talk about the world building and the mood? Because it does have its own very specific mood. Like the intro actually really impressed me. Just that in itself, you know, you watch that and you think this is going to be a good movie. Someone's put some thought into making this original and not generic.
Absolutely. And again, that's what drew me to the script was this interesting mythology. And as you dive into the world of bees and beekeeping, you realize that this is a symbol and a metaphor that follows every civilization. You know, Napoleon would wear golden bees on his uniform. You know, the beekeeper as the first job of civilization. You know, as Jeremy Irons says in the movie, no bees, no agriculture, no civilization. And this concept of this hidden hand that can go in and fix things when they're broken and then quietly exit. So that mysterious force is really fascinating. And I think it lends itself to more movies in this space.
Mm. Do you find those are quite important to find those? I suppose they're like extra metaphors that are completely relevant to the plot, but also not completely relevant to the character in a way. Like I feel like that's a good sort of indicator of the success of a movie is when that third party element is in there.
Absolutely. And this was a huge lesson for me in a lot of ways, you know, having a mythology to kind of hang everything together beyond like, oh, it's a secret soldier from Program X. But, you know, having this sort of this glue that binds everything and then making a movie that is a little more fun, that is a little more tongue in cheek, that doesn't take itself so seriously, that isn't like solving the problems of the world per se, but giving the audience 2 hours of relief when they don't have to think about what's going on out there.
Yeah. So in terms of more the visual side and prepping with your cinematographer, production designer, that kind of thing, what is your process once you've got a script and it's green lit and you're going into production? Are you heavy on the mood boards? We've discussed shot lists.
It's interesting. You know, there's different styles. Every director has their own sort of personal recipe for how they make a film. I'm ridiculously hands-on and more of the traditional European school of filmmaking, which is where the designer, the DP, and the director really work together to make sure everything's fully integrated. So color palettes, huge thing for me, you know, the color psychology, what is the mood? How does the photography, how does camera placement, how does lens choice affect the tone, the mood, the emotion of a scene? You know, photography is incredibly subjective and every choice adds to that subjectivity. And so to collaborate, you know, with really gifted people like that, is one of my favorite parts of it. I'll do mood boards. I do a lot of photography. I'll go to sets and locations and then take pictures and then adjust and edit them so the crew can understand my thinking. I'll do storyboards. Kind of every technique possible is there. I'll build models. You know, you take a model and then you get like an iPhone camera and you can show, you know, hey, I'm going to want to shoot this. So yeah. The more detail you can get into on that part, avoids chaos. And then of course you get to set and you do everything different anyway.
Yeah. So. Well, what were some of the sort of camera grip decisions that were made maybe as generalizations, obviously that you know, there's certain ways you can shoot action that are stipulated by where you're shooting and that kind of thing.
Well, it's the, you know, the camera I used was the Arri 35 and it's a new camera system. I think we're the first major feature to use that camera and it has, you know, and this is camera geek stuff, but it's 14 stops of dynamic range, which means it sees a lot of information and like film. Mm. And I grew up on film and I understand film and film looks. And with this camera, the color depth and the saturation and the gradation, you normally don't get
especially
that.
The darks as well, like worked really well in some of the early bits in the warehouses. And that was really
nice. You can play with shadow safely because you know there's going to be data, there's going to be information there. And And normally when you shoot digital, it's like a compromise and you're setting kind of a gate that the information is going to get through and the rest gets lost. And and in this case, it was a real pleasure to work with. And then I love anamorphic. I love the 2:3:5 aspect ratio, which is like the classic cinema frame.
Yeah.
And just the behavior of anamorphic lenses. And usually I use like really old lens sets, but in this case, I pretty much used Angino zooms. And these are brand new zooms. And there's just this responsiveness and this quality to them. So in aggregate, all these decisions add up to the look of the film, add up to the tone and the feel of it. And yeah, I could talk about that stuff all day.
Yeah. So let's just go a little bit back to your early leanings, because mm-hmm. this is a studio movie. You started off doing some really good writing and, mm-hmm. and directing, obviously Training Day.
Yes.
What are some of the differences in when you were starting out and you were trying to get that first, well, I guess maybe when you were trying to get that first break?
You know, yeah, I started as a writer. The biggest lesson for me was whenever I chase the market, I'm going to write something someone's going to buy.
Yeah.
Never worked. Never yeah. happened. But the second I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to write something for me that comes from my heart and my truth. And that's where I think the power of a writer really comes into play is when it does come from personal truth, and then people respond to that truth.
Yeah, I think it's a common mishap from filmmakers is they try and make something that they think is going to be popular and it's going to please these people or that person. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, by the time, sometimes a film can take 5 or 10 years to actually get into fruition anyway. Mm-hmm. By this point, some other 7 people maybe have made your movie.
Exactly.
The tastes have changed.
Yes.
It always has to be authentic to you.
That's it.
So what was it like sort of going through that first leap from a writer to a director back into the more slightly more into the indie space? Because it's interesting to see that how you've progressed to Hollywood, because we've got a lot of filmmakers that are doing indie mm-hmm. stuff and they're looking to make bigger budget stuff.
Yeah, I mean, my first directing situation was Harsh Times, and a lot of it was self-financed. I broke the first rule of Hollywood, which is never spend your own money. Mm. I borrowed against the house, and I was naive enough to not know how dumb that was. And fortunately, I didn't lose the house, but I did gain a vocation out of it. I learned I can direct, but I was so green. Nothing can prepare you for directing but directing.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn, and it's taken years to build confidence as a director and really find my voice. It's the most terrifying moments were, you know, you show up in the morning and the whole crew's looking at you for answers.
Yeah.
And it's just people and equipment and a vague idea of what we're supposed to be doing, and you have to make a decision.
I think on one hand, when you, I mean, I think I can remember doing that, just putting in money that shouldn't have been into a film. But I think at some point there is that moment when you're trying to break in where you have to put it all on the line and you have to sort of say, I'm going to commit everything to this.
Yeah.
And maybe it's an internal thing just to commit yourself to that process.
You have to trust yourself at a certain point. I think the secret, especially if you're beginning, is you need some experienced people around you. You need people who can advise and counsel, because it is easy to get in over your head really fast, and it's so expensive, and it's such a big burn rate on the money, even at any scale, you know. And you know, the sort of responsibility and fear and everything else from a $100 million movie feels just the same on set if it's a $3 million movie, because it's the same pressure. And being able to work with that pressure is the hallmark of a filmmaker. That's what it really is being able to work under pressure.
Was a big part of that pressure starting out, I suppose, going from writing and directing, working with big casts? Because now you work with, you know, big cast on so many things. I imagine that is maybe dulled down a little bit. But the first time.
Well, it's always intimidating. It's always intimidating because, you know, movie stars are movie stars for a reason. And they know who they are. They know what their capabilities are. And as a director, you have to know them as a person, but also understand them professionally and sort of the magic of what they do. And there's always that moment where, you know, you're kind of like dancing around each other and who's this person and how's this going to work? Mm. And you know, then there's sort of a moment of surrender, which is like, okay, I trust you. You trust me. We're going to figure this out. Okay. Yeah. We're a team now. And that's my favorite part of it is like, once you kind of get past the situation and the pressure and it's just like a couple people creating something together.
I suppose that it's communication, isn't it? As long as you're discussing the thing that you're trying to make and you know what you're talking about to some degree, that's probably where you get past the nerves and the discommunication.
That's it 100%. It's, you know, the star needs to know what you're doing. Even if you don't, what do they say? Fake it till you make it, you know, which is a real thing. Mm. Because you're engineering an artistic product, you're engineering a cultural product, and there's no guaranteed outcomes. So, you know, me having a background as a writer really became my superpower as a director because I understood character, story, drama in a way that, you know, maybe not every director has. And I think there's a respect that actors have for writing. It's almost like this alchemical magic. It's like, you created that out of your head? Yeah, dude, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to either have a very good understanding of writing or emotional intelligence or both. And if you don't have either of those and you're using the actors as placeholders, then you're kind of going to be an alien outside force on set. And there's never going to be that kind of close connection and collaboration.
Yeah. And there's no right answers. And there's absolutely filmmakers that are like, you know, okay, I want you to do exactly this, say the line like this, and are very dogmatic about how they want the product achieved. And then there's a more looser process, which is kind of my process, which is just like get inside the heart of it, have that rapport, have that understanding, and then chase the result together.
Yeah. So what were some of the main lessons from, let's say, Harsh Times and Training Day that you learned before you were sort of going into the more Hollywood fair?
With Training Day, it was seeing, a script that I'd worked on for so long and it was so close to me, go through the process. It's like you have this child, this infant that you've nourished and you hand it over and then someone else is going to raise the child and they make their parenting decisions. And, sometimes I would be like, I don't understand what's going on right now or necessarily like it. But then once I saw the result, I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Mm. And so a lot of it is being open to collaboration. And it's tough because there's a lot of people in your ear. There's a lot of questions. Yeah. There's a lot of demands. And if you're not centered in your vision, it can go sideways really fast and then nothing works. And yet at the same time, I've made some really bad calls on set. It's just part of the process. And so to be able to trust someone to come up and say, hey, there's a better way of doing this. Yeah. Or have you thought about this?
It's not about being perfect.
Yeah.
And also, you can't be infallible on the set. I think it's one of those things.
It's giving yourself permission to be wrong and that much responsibility. People can go to a place of ego of I must project this perfect persona of the person in charge. And if you can get past that and just be a human being and listen to people and not be dogmatic and not assume that everything you know is right, that's the way.
And I suppose sometimes you do have the answer in post as well. And no one on set could have figured it out in that situation anyway.
Yeah.
So you just have to carry on the ship in the right direction. And
1,000%. I mean, movies are made in post. Movies are made in editing. You can make vastly different versions of a film in edit. And then a lot of times, I always say you don't know how to make the movie until you've made the movie.
Yeah.
Which is like the most frustrating part. And it doesn't always work the way you think it's going to. In fact, it usually doesn't.
Yeah.
And so having an amazing editor, having voices you trust, and then being open to solutions, and sometimes you go on any reshoot stuff and it's like, I missed this moment or the audience didn't get the information I needed to get to them. There's always a little bit of cleanup, but it's such a plastic medium that it it can be forgiving and unforgiving at the same time.
Mm. So are there any sort of genres or areas that you're really interested in discovering that you haven't maybe gone into? Because you've done some really, really interesting sort of prestige indie stuff. You've done some great blockbusters. Where are you kind of, where are you feeling now on that scale?
So I really liked making Beekeeper. I really liked that idea of like fun escapist cinema. And I kind of want to explore that lane a little bit more and kind of the chase the instant action classic thing.
Mm.
But, and this is crazy, but I really want to make a musical.
Oh, like, cool.
Okay. I have so much respect for performers and performance and music and song and musicality and that form of expression. It's something I'd love to explore. Like one of my favorite movies is Black Swan, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It goes inside like the creative process. It's one of the best movies about what it feels like to be an artist.
Yeah.
And how we self-critique and so much judgment and how we can be our own worst enemies. And yet somehow how greatness can come from that. So, you know, I think there's something in there I'm chasing.
That's awesome. Just one very, very quick bit of advice that you would give to maybe yourself or someone else trying to break in.
Wow. I mean, it's such a different business now than when I started. The competition is so high. The bar is so high that to break in, your work has to be absolutely exceptional.
Right.
Beyond exceptional. It has to be 0.0001% beyond. And to that, I would say, if you can create from truth, if you can create from honesty, and it isn't so much about, oh, I have to do this entirely different thing that no one's seen before, just telling a story we've heard before, but from a place of like absolute authenticity and honesty. And I feel like that's something that is missing a little bit in cinema right now is authenticity and truth and human truth. And so you can never go wrong by understanding kind of the human soul and just how do you express that? And then my further advice would be, if you want to direct, get your hand on a camera, do it. Don't ask permission. Make mistakes, learn from those mistakes. Don't stop, grind, get on a set, learn the processes, be in the environment, meet actors. You know, if you can't get a camera, get two actors together, write a scene and just grind and experiment and learn. There's no other way to do it.
Fantastic. Thank you. This has been an absolute pleasure. And the movie is amazing. I really enjoyed it. I laughed and was exhilarated in equal measure. Thanks for joining.
Really appreciate that. Thank you. Great questions.
Thanks.
There we go. So that was David airing his thoughts.
Oh, very nice. That was Dom and David chatting there all about his career, The Beekeeper, obviously, which is out now. Go watch it.
Wasn't it a lovely photo of us?
The photo of the two of you is lovely, actually. It's very romantic.
Yeah.
Yeah, the light is good. What I really liked about that chat was you were talking with him and he mentioned about how he liked working with UK crews, film crews, DOPs, from gaffers to grips, makeup artists, designers. And I think in the UK, we have an amazing array of talent here. And I think the Americans love coming over and working with us because I don't know why. American crews are also probably amazing too. I haven't worked with that many. But the word from Americans when they come here is how good our crews are. And I think it's changed from the days where George Lucas came over and he didn't understand that an alarm would go off in the middle of a scene and everyone would have a tea break. You know, it has changed now and everyone is very much focused on the work and very much wants to get stuff done and is very quick. What's your opinion on what he said there, Dom?
100% right. I've worked with a lot of UK crew. I haven't worked tremendously with American crew, but I will say that, you know, when you're relying on goodwill, your crew are very, you know, especially in the indie world, your crew are incredibly important. And, you know, that's one of the biggest things. I think just as important as casting your film, you've got to make sure everyone's on the same page. They know what they're getting in for. I think you've got to be honest as a producer up front, what they're getting in for as well. And you've got to be honest with yourself. And I think, you know, UK crews, like, they appreciate honesty and for, you know, by and large, you can get some great people that are willing to sort of jump into the mud a lot of the time, so to speak.
Yes. And I think it is also about you treat them in the right way as well and respecting them. And yeah, hey, we've all made mistakes in the past, but we learn from these and we go, okay, how do we make it better? How do we make it better for our crews? How do we overcome the issues we've had in the past and make sure that things are safe and well and okay? And, you know, I feel that it has changed. I do feel that things are adapting, but I agree with you. I think the UK crews are wonderful to work with. Obviously, my shoot was over in Bulgaria, and I have had nothing but joy from working with the Bulgarian crew. Me and Andy Roger can be having a chat about how we're going to do the shot. You know, we're talking it through, and suddenly they'll have laid the track and it's ready for you. Is this what you want? And you're like, oh my God, thank you. Yes. Can you move it a bit?
And you've just been tickling his beard in the meantime and not realizing time had flown. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think it is quite amazing that when you've got a great gaffer or grip who is listening to you as a director and you as a DOP chatting, and he's going, oh, okay, I know what they're going to shoot next. And after that, I know what they're going to shoot because they've just discussed it. And sometimes when you're on set, it's very hard to then announce to the world, because normally you'd say to your first AD, hey, these are the shots, this is what we're going to do. And you hope your first AD will then tell the team. Sometimes it just doesn't happen because of time. So if your grip and gaffer are listening to you, have these conversations, then they can just go, yeah, do you mean this? And they can already be telling their crew what they mean. And that speeds everything up. And I think that's what I've learned from, you know, certainly in Bulgaria, but also UK crews as well. It's very important that team is on side and listening and paying attention.
Mm.
How was your shoot in Scotland?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, I sort of love Scotland anyway, and I've got, you know, various things that I've got sort of planned up there. So it's great. You know, for me, it was a nice experience sort of building up a crew and infrastructure up there. But, you know, more than that, it's just the scenery is beautiful. The people have great sort of sense of humours. And, you know, it's a nice challenge. It's a nice challenge to build a crew when you don't actually know a lot of them. I mean, on our one, we, you know, due to the timing, it was all sort of quite, you know, we had a very rapid deadline to get everything together. So I brought like two or three crew that I'd sort of known and had kept in contact with in the UK, sort of London based. So that, you know, there's a couple of like really good collaborators that sort of came to the rescue, you know, last minute, sort of fill crew positions that we needed. But then, you know, most of the hires were in Scotland, and, you know, you're just having to have conversations with people completely out the door, like cold turkey. This is the deal. This is the money. This is, you know, the shoot. And sort of, you know, putting that together is quite exciting. And they were really good quality crew, like really good.
From working with crew as a producer, what worked for you? What has worked?
I think the main thing is to be honest up front. And sometimes, you know, when you're doing lower budget stuff or stuff where the budget's restricted by the number of days or the, you know, the expense of other logistics, you've either got to, you know, tempt people in with the script, you know, sort of, you know, working with them as a sort of passion project basis. But it's got to be fair. You've got to sort of make sure that your wages are sort of, you know, fairly equal and you know, transparent across the board. If people are sort of doing you any kind of favor, you know, below sort of high end Netflix rates, and you know, that's often a sort of a consideration at the moment, is, you know, people sort of coming off studio stuff. But I think, you know, I think it's how you deal with people. I think it's you know, it's getting a good recommendation from a friend of a friend. It's having a decent team. It's being personable, and as I said before, it's really being honest about people, you know, with people, and not trying to hoodwink them about what the situation is. And 9 times out of 10, once people do sign up, when you've told them everything about the shoot, they're in it, you know, and you actually don't have any trouble from them on set, you know, even if it's tough and even if it's really intense. But it's when you sort of try and sell the dream, and then, you know, little details sort of come to light as the shoot's going on, and, oh, this person's getting paid more than me, and, you know, well, why haven't you organized this? It's those kind of things. It's actually the dishonesty, I think, a lot of the time that makes people come undone. It's not the schedule or the structure or the crew or any of that stuff.
That's really interesting, and I think it's absolutely right. I think the more honest you can be up front and say, listen, this is all the money we've got. It's your choice if you want to be here. I know it's shitty. It's totally your call. And then at least you're being honest about what the situation is on indie films. Or you're saying, you know, look, this is going to be hard work. It's going to be night shoots. You're going to be in a crappy hotel. Look, understand that. please, you know, it's your choice. Make your choice. And if you're in it, you're in it. And let's get on with this as a team, because we're all going to be in the same. I'm not going to be in some fancy hotel down the road. We're all in this. We're all staying in a crappy caravan or whatever. Yeah, that can be bonding, actually, as long as I agree with you. To be honest, is better than sort of saying, no, it's going to be amazing. And hey, we'll get to, you know, you'll be on the next one where it's big, big money, all that shit. So come on now. Most crews have been around the block.
But also, it is also making sure that, you know, everything isn't shit.
Yes, of course.
You know, there are some nice perks. I mean, you know, like for instance, I mean, just on the catering side, you know, I found a pub that was within like 50-minute drive of one of the locations. And, you know, I looked at the menu. The menu is like really decent, you know, sort of what you get in a gastropub in London. But being Scotland, it was about sort of half the price. And, you know, I just spoke to the owners and I said, like, look, this is our budget. You know, I didn't say, like, what can you do it for? I said, this is our budget. You know, what can you figure out? And they were able to put together like a really decent menu, high quality food, you know, different options, gluten-free, veggie, that, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was, you know, it was all good sort of quality food. And it was, you know, within a reasonable budget. And, you know, we didn't have to employ some catering company and spend loads of money on that, because we were out in the sticks in, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. And sometimes it's just about, you know, having an honest conversation and saying, like, you know, look, you know, you're a local company. We'll get you some local press. When we have a local screening, you know, your company name is going to be out there. You know, this is the rate on the food. And you know, they were actually just excited to be part of the film. So it's taking those kind of approaches to make sure you deliver quality and you keep your crew happy. And you also maybe help some local businesses on some kind of collaboration. You know, it's not always about money.
No, you're absolutely right. Sometimes people want to do it because they, like you say, they enjoy being part of a film. That's not crew necessarily. That's when you're asking for favors from, like, say, hotels or, yeah, your food that you might get. So yeah, it is all that. It is doing your best to get out there. But it's really interesting what David said about UK crews. And it's not the first time we've heard it. So keep it up, UK crew members. Keep up being amazing. Because it just helps.
And you, Scottish crews.
Great Britain crews. Keep it up. It's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, when we say UK crews, yeah, we actually mean Great Britain crews. And I apologise to Scottish people and Welsh people and Irish people. Yeah. Okay, cool. So next week, as Dom has said, we have Ty Sheridan on, which is super exciting. The amazing actor who I saw in Cannes last year chatting with a director who's been on our podcast twice, who's a good friend of Phil Hawkins.
Francis Annan.
It is Francis Annan. Yeah. We've got some shout outs for Boland Shoes, which is Terry Dwyer's and Dean Fisher's movie, which was directed by Ian Poulsen Davies, which is on Sky Movies now, just like David Ayres' Beekeeper. Boland Shoes is out. It stars Tim Spall, and it is fantastic. It is called Boland's Shoes, and it is really fun, brilliant movie. And obviously, Terry was the producer of my movie, The Stranger in Our Bed, but now her film, Boland's Shoes, the next one, is out. So do go support and watch that. It's a brilliant indie film. And you can listen to the episode with her. 358. We also got shout outs to Faith Elizabeth, who is doing a Cannes, because Cannes is coming up in May, ladies and gentlemen, from the 14th to the 21st, if I remember correctly. And she's just launched her Yes, She Can How To Workshops, which is hosted with the London Independent Film Festival and also with the Met Film School students. And she is doing a Cannes intensive workshop at the Met Film School on April the 13th, which is a couple of weeks away, and it's going to be open to the public. It's a four-hour workshop for all genders going to Cannes or planning to go in the future, explaining the festival, but also an interactive section on networking, mindset, strategy, etc. And we at the Filmmakers Podcast are giving you, lovely listener, a discount of 20% off with the code FILMPOD. That's capitals FILMPOD, Film Pod. Link to that will be in the show notes. And interestingly, all the money being raised from this workshop is going towards supporting Yes She Can in Cannes, which is their big events that they have planned, which I went to last year, which was fantastic. Dom, you went along as well, where they'll be distributing badges and newspapers. So any support in helping them will mean they can reach more filmmakers and support even more attendees. They're also hosting a women's only villa, which me and Dom won't be attending, sadly, offering places at cost price to support the guests further. So that information is also on the ticket link, and the ticket link is in the show notes. There you go. If you're going to Cannes, yes, you can. .com.
What's the most popular B musician?
Have you been
Justin Bieber?
Have you just been holding your breath, waiting for me to finish?
Justin Bieber.
Just to do this. Basically, look, if you don't, Beekeeper is full of bee puns, and I think Dom might have done most of them.
Beethoven. Yeah.
Are these like 4-year-old pun jokes that you're looking at?
Yes. Yeah. They are. Yeah. Yeah. I've got a good one to end on.
Oh, God. Okay.
Where do worker bees go on vacation? Singapore.
Well, let's go out there and pollinate the world with filmmaking tips and tricks, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. You didn't pick up on the pollination joke there? The pun?
Oh, I did. Yeah. It was all part of show business.
You bumbled over your own words there, you... Yeah.
Okay.
Right. We should buzz off, shouldn't we?
This has got a bit out of hand, isn't it?
Oh, it's barely believable. Right, we will see you next Tuesday when we have Ty Sheridan, the amazing actor and now producer, joining us to chat all about his life and career in making films. So until then, go out and make your films, or at least try.
Yes, and be positive.
Yeah. Till next Tuesday. Take care, everyone. Bye, Dom.
Bye-bye.
Bye.